The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, the simplest, most powerful website creator that helps you make headlines with your own stunning online presence. Explore elegant templates, Getty image integration, and more at squarespace.com, and use the code Guardian to get 10% off.
Hello, I am Natalie Nahai, and this is Tech Weekly. Have you ever subscribed to a mailing list by mistake or booked travel insurance without really noticing? And how did that 10-year warranty on your new laptop somehow sneak its way into your online shopping basket? Well, it wasn't a mistake. Someone designed that software to deliberately mislead, misinform, and misdirect you. They're called dark patterns, user interfaces that are carefully crafted using psychological techniques to trick us into doing things we might otherwise not do. And they're everywhere. This week, we'll be investigating the murky world of dark patterns, what they are, how they work, and why businesses use them, and whether they can be used as a force for good, not evil. And as a new exhibition dedicated to Ada Lovelace opens at the Science Museum, we'll be finding out why the Victorian computing genius is the hottest ticket in town 200 years on. This is Tech Weekly from The Guardian. If you're one of the 364 million users of LinkedIn, you've no doubt found yourself on the receiving end of dozens of follow-up emails apparently sent from your friends and your contacts. But your friends didn't send those emails. They were harvested from their webmail accounts. All this despite LinkedIn claiming that it will not store your password or email anyone without your permission. And as a result, LinkedIn has had its knuckles wrapped with a class action lawsuit to the tune of $13 million. So joining me to discuss this now is digital product designer Kenneth Bowles and Channel 4 news tech journalist Jeff White. Welcome, both of you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So Jeff, first of all, dark patterns. What exactly are they?
Well, as you said, dark patterns is little nudges and little tips and little tricks that digital services websites use to try and change people's behavior, ideally to get them to sign up, to buy more products, to use a service more often. You see them everywhere. Once you've heard that phrase, dark patterns, and you understand what it is, you just see it all over the place. I mean, the classic example is a page saying, do you want to sign up? Do you want to do X actions? Do you want to enter your email address here? And there's a massive button that says OK on it. And then in tiny little grey letters that are almost invisible, you see skip this step on the other side. And that's a dark pattern. That's an instance of dark pattern behaviour.
Brilliant. So is this deception, and why don't regulations exist, or do they exist?
It's not illegal, and the website designers, I'm sure, would argue that they're just being smart. I mean, I've read some fantastic blogs about this that talk about people who are actually at the sharp end of designing websites, and bosses say, look, we need to get more users to sign up. You put the change in, you make the little no thanks button tiny, and sure enough, you get a bigger percentage of people signing up. In terms of the regulations, it's sharp practice. I don't think these things are illegal, but there are quite strict rules around if you do gather people's data, you can only use it for the purposes for which people gave it to you. Now, what's important is when you give that data, when you click that OK button, are you being told enough about what data you're giving and about how that data will be used? And I think that cuts the heart of the way LinkedIn behaves as a website and this whole legal case they got involved in.
Mm. And actually, wasn't there earlier this year, there was an EU law that came through for Consumer Rights Directive looking at changing practices so people can no longer online do the whole kind of bait and switch technique?
Yes. This is to do with things like putting something in your basket and you having to take it out. It's a sort of classic dark pattern behavior, basically. You sign up for something. I mean, what's interesting is this has obviously come back off the back of the PPI scandal. And I think, to be honest, in terms of impact on people, that has been the largest instance of you weren't given a choice about this. It was just dumped in there and you were expected to remove it. So I think people are starting to get wise to these kind of things.
Mm. So why do you think that apparently reputable companies think that they can actually get away with this? I mean, we are talking about the sharp end of things, but isn't this kind of making a foray into the world of deception?
Businesses are about growth. The cardinal rule of business is you must grow. And with tech businesses, that is absolutely critical. If you make widgets in a factory and you sell them in shops, growth is making more widgets in more factories and selling them in more shops. Mm. If you're into social media, which is what LinkedIn are into, growth is getting more users. Any tactic, any strategy you can deploy to grow your number of users is worth looking at. And from the get-go, LinkedIn have been, some would say, quite aggressive in terms of getting more users, in terms of capitalizing on the users who signed up to try and get more users. My experience of LinkedIn has been that when the website wants access to your contacts book, it's not made completely obvious that that's what they're asking to do. So the message will be, you know, see who else you know on LinkedIn. Now, actually, in order to see who else I know on LinkedIn, LinkedIn wants access to my Gmail contacts book, and they merrily get access to it. So at that moment, my worry would be, am I told enough about what data they're going to get and what they're going to do with it? It's worth pointing out, though, in this case, LinkedIn settled this case. As far as they're concerned, they didn't necessarily do anything wrong. And they've said, look, in future, we may keep doing this. We'll just be more upfront with people about how many emails we're going to send out on their behalf.
And there is a piece in there around transparency. One of the other things I think is interesting, you're saying about growth in tech companies, is when you look at companies such as Facebook, who are also trying to retain their user base, when you try to unsubscribe, they make it really hard. I tried this 2 years ago, and the only option that's available initially is to deactivate the account. And if you want to delete it, you have to reactivate it, go back in. And then they use this horrendous kind of emotional blackmail saying, Jeff is still on here, won't you miss Jeff's updates? I'm like, this is really, really mean, go away. So there is also an element there. So who do you think are some of the other big culprits that you've covered, perhaps on Channel 4 News?
We haven't covered this massively on Channel 4 News because it's so, I think it's because it's so ubiquitous and it's so subtle and there are so many tiny instances of doing it. I mean, the LinkedIn case is interesting in that it's thrown a huge amount of light onto this because it's a website that's used by, as you said, hundreds of millions of people. And this friend of mine described it somewhat unfairly as the herpes of social media. Everybody's had the LinkedIn email. Yeah, I'd like to connect with you on LinkedIn. And so because service is so big and because it's been so assertive about trying to get more users, it's thrown a lot of attention on it. But you see these patterns everywhere. You see, I mean, I was on Ocado last night and Ocado will sort the products that you want to browse through in order of categories. So your favorites will come first, then the offers will come next. And for each product you search, because I'm a cheapskate, I want to show them in price order, right? For each product you search, you have to change the settings. So you see these patterns everywhere you go once you're looking out for them. And so I think that for Channel 4 News, we could do a story on dark patterns every day.
Mm. Yeah, it really is something that's ubiquitous. So Kenneth, you work to promote ethical design, which is perfect lead on from dark patterns. So why do people employ these dirty techniques, do you think?
Well, I mean, I think ultimately they do them because sadly they work. As we heard earlier, in a business where growth is such a core metric and pretty much the thing that's being chased, then any technique that helps boost that is obviously going to be worth pursuing. There is also potential benefit for the bottom line. You know, the old pattern, which, you know, as you rightly say, is now illegal, but the old pattern of sneaking items into a user's e-commerce basket, clearly that could, in theory, generate more revenue through, you know, shipping more product. So I suspect many businesses are aware that they are getting into slightly murky territory, but they also don't particularly care if the results, you know, are clear enough. Essentially, you know, they justify the means.
So how do you think that dark patterns make us do what they do? And what are some of the psychological techniques that are at work?
I think it's important here to differentiate between dark patterns and just plain sort of bad design. This isn't bad design in terms of just oversights and sloppiness and carelessness. This is deliberate, intelligently done design, which has the sole aim of essentially trying to trick people into certain behavioural patterns. Any designer who's literate in cognitive psychology and so on, which will account for most of the designers inside tech companies these days, understands some of the psychological principles that underpin how people interact with technology and information. Now, you can use those for positive intent, and you can also use them for these sort of slightly murkier applications. A lot of them are based around sort of principles of how we direct attention. There's a dark pattern, which is known as the misdirection pattern, which essentially is sort of a magician's sleight of hand. It's drawing attention to some part of the interface or some part of the screen in the hope that you will overlook actually a more critical part that may be acting to your disadvantage. A very famous airline that we all know have some sort of brand toxicity issues, shall we say, have been known to sneak insurance opt-outs within very long lists where you wouldn't think to look, and you're focusing elsewhere on the page. So it's this sort of sleight of hand that we often see put in. As I say, there's no way that's happened by accident. That's clearly and intelligently designed, essentially to try and hoodwink people into taking insurance they may not have otherwise wanted.
So what are some of the worst examples of the dark patterns that we spring to mind? We've had one example of an airline, and there are actually quite a lot of them doing some of these things now. Mm-hmm. What are some others that people might have come across or might not have come across?
There's a pattern known as forced continuity, which is when you sign up for a product and maybe it has a one-month trial, something like that, and you think, well, this is fantastic. It's a free trial. Great, let's go for it. And you sign up, and then lo and behold, you didn't realize you'd actually signed up to a subscription program. Maybe you gave your credit card information in good faith without understanding then this would be a rolling monthly billable system. A lot of people, you know, forget that those things exist and then get a nasty bill shock when they look at their statement, say 6 months down the line. Some businesses will make it terrifically easy to sign up online, but then make it impossible to opt out, to cancel your subscription online, and instead force you to call a number, even sometimes a premium rate number, to unsubscribe. And of course, you know, it might be 30-minute waiting times and all this sort of stuff. So it's a sadly all too common pattern. It's perhaps a case of, you know, something looks too good to be true, then perhaps it is. But the small print is so small or so faintly grey that a lot of users aren't actually getting into the meat of what's happening here.
And I wonder here, when we talk about dark patterns and about choice, we also have to look at free will and also the choice of the consumer, that when we make these decisions, is the responsibility on our backs or is it on others? So, for instance, if you've got something which is really easy to take action on, so a great example, I tried to sign up to the Sunday Times to see an article the other day and looked at their cancellation policy for the 1 month, the sort of 30-day, £1 trial. And you have to cancel within 15 days of signing up, otherwise you get billed £26 for the next month. It's just, so there's a lot of established brands that are doing this. And so is it our responsibility to be more careful about what boxes we tick or don't tick?
As a designer, I'm always hesitant to shift blame onto the user. The user has many other things going on in their lives. I mean, you know, we shouldn't have to worry ourselves with this aspect of technology. We shouldn't have to be scouring sites to look for the catch, to look for the faint grey small print. I think designers and product owners within tech companies have an ethical responsibility to be more upfront about their practices, to help clearly communicate the intention of the service and when billing, you know, billing cycles will take place and so on. Of course, consumers can help protect themselves by being just that little bit more aware of some of those techniques that, you know, some of these shady practices that exist. But I'm particularly keen on helping to solve this within the tech community, to help designers and product owners make that right decision and behave in, frankly, ways that I think are to the greater credit of the tech industry.
So what can we do about it? How can we arm ourselves against dark patterns? We'll find out next. So if dark patterns are employed by the internet equivalent of Darth Vader, then who are the Jedi Knights? And is there such a thing as light patterns? We're joined now by designer Dan Lockton, who created something called the Design with Intent Toolkit, which is a collection of design patterns aimed at changing our behaviour for the good of society and the environment. So Dan, can you talk us through what this toolkit is?
It was some work I did, really, because I was interested in, I guess, what we might call dark patterns across other areas of other areas other than just digital design as well. So looking at like the built environment and looking at government policies and looking at physical products and how things have been designed to try to get us to do different things in a way. And almost as like how perhaps policy is embedded in the design of the world in a way. So I started doing that sort of research. But I became interested in how you could use some of those techniques in ways that actually help people. And so there's always a tension between actually, you know, the intentions behind things. Are they intended, you know, even though it may be intended to help you, you know, achieve better, you know, learn more about products that might be great for you and so on. How do you, you know, how do you negotiate that kind of intent? So I kind of collected a lot of examples of these kind of patterns. Some of them are dark, some of them are lighter perhaps, some of them are things that are just worth exploring in the world from lots of different products and environment, built environment and physical products and digital products, and put them together into a kind of toolkit, which is not necessarily saying this is what you should do. It's almost like a library of patterns that exist that you could recognise and identify. So it's perhaps a kind of a cross between something aimed at designers as a tool they can use, but also perhaps something that you could use to explore things around you to understand what patterns exist in a way that are affecting your behaviour.
Fascinating. And why is ethical web design so important?
I think in a way that the naivety of some of the early, well, not necessarily early, but some of the web design we've encountered before, where it was almost, we weren't necessarily, the agenda of things was perhaps clearer. So we went to use things as a tool. This thing did this, this thing did that, and we used them in particular ways. And I think now we've got to a stage where there are so many layers of things embedded. There are so many other services that are linked, whether it's, you know, whether it's actually cookies or tracking people across sites or cross-media things. But essentially, we've got to a stage where everything we encounter, we are on some level having to engage with it a bit more like perhaps a person, right? We assume that someone might have some sort of agenda or they've got some interest or something. So I think we've got to a stage where we're almost having to kind of negotiate our response to the services and the sites we encounter in a way that perhaps we didn't before. Mm. It's just not so transparent.
So it sounds as though some of the solution is going to be in consumers themselves becoming more conscious of what's going on and maybe not taking the initial choice that's presented to them as the intention that's actually going to be the one that's presented. So what's in it for companies and why should they use positive design if, like Jeff was saying earlier, their impetus is to grow the company and get more users through the door?
It's a good question. I think if growth is the only thing that you target, then the quality of the quality of the service potentially decreases. So, someone adding you on LinkedIn is now not perhaps worth as much as it was when you only had people that you knew and you knew that they'd invited you explicitly. So I think if it's solely about targeting growth, then it loses, network effect of greater numbers is only really valuable when there's the qualitative sort of content aspect. And I think that means that perhaps services that curate things a bit more closely or that actually, retain that value or retain or perhaps help the user understand what's going to happen to their data a bit better. It retains some of that value, which I guess is just a slightly different model.
Yeah, absolutely. So there are companies out there that use dark patterns in a positive way. I'm going to open this up to all three of you. And if so, how?
I was at an internet dating conference the other day and they made some really interesting points about apps that try to get permissions on your phone. So a little window comes up saying this app wants permission to access your contacts book or your location. And it's the default Apple designed prompt saying allow or don't allow. Mm. What they were saying was if you preface that within the app with a couple of screens that say, look, this is a social app. The more people you get to know, the more chance you've got of a date. You could get lucky. And then the Apple default notification comes up, people are far more likely to click OK because you said to them, look, the benefits of saying OK are X, Y, and Z, and then you get the prompt. So I think what's interesting about that is it's not a dark pattern. It's a pattern, but it's not trying to hide itself or be deceitful. It's trying to prep somebody to take a particular decision. So I think there's a huge range of activities that different sites do.
And what we're talking about really there is providing people with the information they need to contextualize the prompt so that they can then make a much more informed decision. So Kenneth, do you think there's a need perhaps for a code of conduct for companies? Can we be that prescriptive?
I think potentially this discussion comes up every now and then. I think the topic of ethics bubbles up a little bit on the mailing lists and discussions. And every now and then someone proposes the idea of the equivalent of a Hippocratic oath for design and so on. My concern with that is that the field is still very emergent. Good practice is still it's maybe not accurate to say it's unclear, but it's fuzzy around the edges. And some of the social contexts are still very new to us, particularly as we move into an even more mobile world and even more wearables and so on. We don't yet exactly know how that's going to pan out. So I'm a little wary of being overly prescriptive at this stage and to say, here are the principles, 12 ethical principles that you need in order to do good design. For me, what matters is actually having this conversation in the first place, because the unethical practice that's out there in the world happens because there is a lack of consideration of ethics. It's not because someone ponders these issues very, very intelligently and then chooses the dark side, as you put it. It's because these conversations, frankly, aren't happening in a lot of Silicon Valley companies and elsewhere. So anything that helps get that issue on the table, I think, has to be a step forward, whether it's a specific code of practice or not.
Mm. It's interesting because this links in quite nicely with what Ollie was discussing last week around advertising and privacy, sort of taking back control of the experience that we have online and people becoming more aware of the kind of experience they want and then choosing, for instance, to use a VPN or an ad blocker to filter out the stuff that they don't want to see. Do you think it's possible that we'll end up whitelisting sites somehow that don't use dark patterns, that we could have a repository where people say, okay, I'm going to submit my site, it'll go through some kind of process, and if I'm listed on the site, then users know what to expect. Is that also a possibility?
I actually think there's some mileage in that potentially. one of the closest parallels I can think of is the Plain English campaign's checkmark for, you know, saying essentially we follow good guidelines for clear communication and so on. I could certainly see a future in which some third party, be that a professional body or whoever else is best placed to offer it, essentially whitelisting or having some kind of almost a kite mark for ethical behaviour, if you like. I think we're a long way from actually realising that, but I think that might be an interesting positive step.
So, Dan, do you think that this is all about taking back control of the web?
I think you'll see increasing numbers of people doing things. I mean, you look at the rise of like the use of ad blocking software, and once it becomes the default in certain browsers or in certain, you know, certain mobile operating systems, I think, you know, to some extent, people taking back control may come partly through people realizing what's going on, but partly also through the systems they're using just not allowing certain things through. Now, it won't block some of the dark patterns in a way, but it would make some of them more apparent. You know, I mean, I suppose 30 years ago, there were a lot of campaigns around like media literacy. You know, should we teach children to understand advertising better and realize that, you know, this may not always be helping them, or it may be things that are intended to sell you something and it may not always be in your best interest. And I think maybe we need some kind of literacy around some of these techniques or persuasion techniques, perhaps, as a precursor to people taking back control.
Great, thank you guys. So coming up, we go right back to the very beginnings of programming to look at the first lady of computing, Ada Lovelace, 200 years on. That's after this.
If you're a developer working on a mobile app or website and you're searching for a simple payment solution, look no further than Braintree V.0. This snippet of code allows you to accept PayPal, Apple Pay, credit and debit cards and more from customers around the world, all with a single integration. For more information and to try out the sandbox, go to braintreepayments.com/techweekly now.
So this year, it's 200 years since the birth of computing pioneer and genius Ada Lovelace. And to mark the fact, the Science Museum in London has just opened a really exciting exhibition celebrating the world's first tech visionary, both a Brit and a woman. Joining us now is curator Dr. Tilly Blythe. So this year, we've seen a graphic novel, The Thrilling Adventures of Lovelace and Babbage by Sidney Padua, a BBC4 documentary, and now your exhibition at the Science Museum. So what's the fascination with Ada 200 years on?
The fascination, I guess, is really that she's been labelled as the world's first computer programmer. I think one of the things that we show in the exhibition is really whether this is justifiable, whether this label is correct. So what we've tried to do is, for the first time, bring together portraits of Ada Lovelace, some of her own personal letters, letters that other people wrote to her, and some of the original engines that Charles Babbage himself created, and were the things that inspired some of Ada Lovelace's work.
Fascinating. Can you tell us maybe a bit more about what it was that she achieved and how important she might have been to the development of computing as we now know it today?
So it's actually quite a complex story, unsurprisingly. So Charles Babbage was a mathematician, an engineer, really, you know, he tried his hand at many different things. He was building a series of different calculating engines, the difference engine and also an analytical engine. Many of his ideas never came to fruition. He went through various different engineering diagrams and plans, but he only actually created parts of the difference engine and a small part of the analytical engine. So he gave a lecture when he was in Turin, and as part of that lecture, it was actually written up by a man called Luigi Menabrea. So Menabrea goes on to be probably the most famous person in this whole story because he goes on to become the Prime Minister of Italy. But he writes this up, and Ada Lovelace decides that she's going to translate this paper. So this paper is the only real description of Charles Babbage's designs for the analytical engine. And in her translation, she writes a series of quite complicated notes and expands massively on Charles Babbage's own ideas. Mm. So she's not just taking the translation from French to English, she's actually massively expanding the ideas that it contains.
So taking them and running with them, really.
Exactly. So she actually goes far further than we might say that Charles Babbage himself did. So perhaps the thing she's known for, the reason she has this label as the world's first computer programmer, is she writes an algorithm, a set of instructions for the analytical engine to help it to show how it would explain Bernoulli numbers, you know, a mathematical sequence. But in doing that, actually, I would say her more important contribution is really this kind of philosophical interpretation that she gives the engine. So she writes this description of how you'd ask it to do, you know, useful work. But she, the thing that's really important is this note A that she writes, that's really a kind of much broader interpretation of what the engine is capable of.
Extraordinary. Now, her personal life is almost as extraordinary as what she achieved in mathematics. She was the daughter of Lord Byron, liked to gamble, and died aged just 36, so really quite young. Is this something that the exhibition also looks at?
Yeah, we very much look at her influences. So, as you know, her father died when she was very young, but it was her mother who really decided that she needed to be educated in a whole range of different things, particularly in mathematics. And she took her on a tour of the Midlands and the north of England at a time when there's incredible technological change happening around the country. So it's there that she sees things like a ribbon loom that's using Jacquard punch cards to create pieces of ribbon. And even then, at this, you know, tender teenage years, I think she's around 17, she actually acknowledges that this reminds her of Babbage's own engines. So even at that age, she's beginning to think about the possibilities of programming and of punch cards.
That's just incredible that she would make those connections. So if there's one contribution that we could know Ada Lovelace for, what would it be?
So I would say it's actually this philosophical interpretation that she gives the engine. So unlike Charles Babbage, who was very much focused on the engine for mathematics, she saw the possibility of the engine to not just deal with maths, but for number to represent something more symbolic. So it could represent, say, musical notes or letters. So it was this ability to see the engine as a general purpose machine, something that could be applied to a whole range of different outputs.
Quite an extraordinary leap to make, then.
Exactly, a massive intellectual leap, and something that actually we don't see again until Alan Turing nearly 100 years later. So, you know, really making a leap intellectually that nobody else has made before.
So she's become also a poster girl for women in tech, and I'm a member of this fantastic list called Ada's List, which is set up by some fantastic women. And every year we celebrate Ada Lovelace Day, which also is something that women in tech tend to hold as quite a lovely thing to do. So why has she become so central to the story of women in tech? And why is this a subject that we feel we have to look at as opposed to just people in tech?
I think she's become such a poster girl, really, because we're looking for role models. You know, it's useful to have women that we can point to in the history of science and technology that we can say have played an important role. I think it's important that we don't get completely hung up on that, that actually, you know, it is questionable how much of a role model Ada Lovelace could play. You know, she was a very aristocratic lady. She was very much part of Victorian high society. She wasn't an achievable role model that many girls today might be able to relate to. So I think, you know, whilst it is important that we have women that we can acknowledge historically, it's also important to look at other more achievable roles. I'd also say perhaps really what we need to do is look at the more nuanced understanding of the role that women did play in the history of science and technology. So as I've talked about, Ada did this translation. That was actually quite a common type of activity for women to do. So they may not have been the person who was perceived to be doing the most innovative work, the most, you know, the first thing, but they were translating or communicating or working in collaboration, doing science and mathematics.
And getting the word out to people.
Exactly, exactly. And that's actually an important part of mathematical and scientific practice. And we need to kind of open up the way we think about the history of maths and science to bring women's stories into that.
Yeah, I would agree. So finally then, before we wrap up, what can visitors expect at the exhibition in terms of what they can see, and how long is it running for?
So it runs for 6 months, and there's some absolutely lovely things. It's a very small, intimate exhibition, but there's a beautiful painting painted by Margaret Carpenter when she first married William King, who became Lord Lovelace. This shows her very proudly showing her wedding ring at just the tender age of 19. There's letters, as we've described. There's the difference engine number one that's held by the Science Museum, and actually was the machine that Ada Lovelace saw at Charles Babbage's house when she was just 17. There's the part of the analytical engine, which is the only part that was created during Charles Babbage's lifetime. And then at the end of the exhibition, there's a rather sad part because, as we said, she died at the age of 36. And there's a small sketch of her done by her mother when she was on her deathbed, which is really quite poignant and helps you to, you know, remember this isn't just an icon. This is a woman that we're talking about. And there's also a piece of her own hair that we've been lent by the family or the descendants of Ada Lovelace.
So quite moving, actually.
It is quite moving. Well, we hope so. I mean, it's really to get across the many different sides of Ada and to help people to really interpret her contribution in a slightly more nuanced and complicated way.
Thanks very much for joining us today. We'll be revisiting Ada Lovelace again in early December for a big special on women in coding for her 200th birthday. Well, that's it for this week. Big thanks to all my guests today, to Tilly Blythe, Jeff White, Kenneth Bowles and Dan Lockton. And thanks for joining me on my first roadshow. I've been Natalie Nahai. You can follow me on Twitter at Natalie Nahai. And this week's producers were Simon Barnard and Alana Chance. Thanks for listening. It will be Ollie again next week and we'll see you then.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.